When Sebastian Richardson, an inmate at Lewisburg Penitentiary in Pennsylvania, refused to live with a cellmate, prison guards put him into restraints that prevented him from being able to make basic human movements. Chrissy Thompson, a staff writer for the Marshall Project, and Joseph Shapiro, an NPR investigations correspondent, looked into what happened to Richardson and other inmates in similar situations, and their article, 28 Days in Chains, about the punishment that these inmates endured, was published on October 26th by the Marshall Project. I'm very pleased it has brought Chrissy Thompson and Joseph Shapiro to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Joseph, what alerted you to this situation?
Well, NPR and the Marshall Project, we've been working together since, since 2015, doing stories about solitary confinement. First, we did a story that looked at the fact that people leave solitary confinement and go straight to the streets without any kind of the support that other prisoners often get. And then from that, one thing that got us interested in double cell solitary confinement was we went to the Bureau of Prisons and they told us put people together because it reduces the number of suicides in solitary confinement, and that is it's a problem. It's true. Prison suicides are most common when in solitary confinement, and suicide does go down if you put two cellmates together, but we found that homicides went up. And we started reporting on that. We also did a story this March looking at double cell solitary confinement, but looking at the level of violence, that got us to Lewisburg because there had been a spate of violence there last year.
And when did you realize the extent of what was happening with the shackling inside prisons?
That came when we started looking at Lewisburg and specifically this case. I think we started with this case of Sebastian Richardson, a man who spent 28 days in shackled for what seemed to us a small issue, that he had refused to be celled with a man that he thought was dangerous, a man who had a reputation for attacking his cellmates.
Right. Chrissy, the man they called the Prophet?
Yeah, that was his self-ascribed nickname, was the Prophet. And what we heard from other men who had been at Lewisburg was this was someone who was erratic. He was known to stay up all night, as though he was in a spelling bee, or singing songs as loudly as possible. As one person told me, just someone who had no respect for his cellmates. And also, Sebastian had heard he had beat up over 20 of the previous men he had been housed with. So when officers brought this man to Sebastian's door, he said, according to him, I can't live with that person. You can't put me in a cell with him. And according to his lawsuit, their response was to lock him in these restraints. So what I was going to say is that's really what brought us to Lewisburg specifically, is we'd been looking at the violence in these double cells. But what we were hearing out of Lewisburg from, over 40 men who had been through there was basically their options were to live in these tiny cells and face that threat of violence, or if they didn't, the guards would respond by locking them in these restraints until they gave in and said, okay, I'll live with whoever you put me with.
Isn't there a lawsuit from Sebastian Richardson that the Marshall Project is involved with?
We're not involved in the lawsuit. Sebastian Richardson is the lead plaintiff of what's attempting to be a class action suit representing all men who have been through the special management unit at Lewisburg about the specific use of restraints and about what they say is a policy of giving men this, as they say, false choice. So that case has been going on since 2011. It's still ongoing.
Joseph, can you talk a little bit about Sebastian Richardson? What was his occupation before he was sent to prison?
He ended up in prison for selling drugs. He was part of a drug-selling ring in Shreveport, Louisiana. He'd been at a previous prison where he'd been charged with attacking a guard. It was something that he disputed. He actually said that he was intervening in a fight between another prisoner and a corrections official. By the way, we should point out, by the way, that the Bureau of Prisons, it admits that Sebastian Richardson was in restraints for these long periods of time. They responded to his lawsuit. They said, 28 days one time, 21 days another time. And Richardson, by the way, so, we described he ends up in in restraints. They take him to a separate room, a separate cell. This is for refusing to take this man that he thought was dangerous as a cellmate that Christie described. They cuff his hands in something guards called T-Rexing, which was common at Lewisburg at the time, not used now, where his hands were cuffed at his chest level, and it was so tight he could barely move them. He said it was painful, it was uncomfortable, then his ankles were chained too, and they take him to a cell where he spent these 28 days. At one point, he's put in the most extreme form of restraint, something called four-point restraints, right, where he's put on a concrete slab. It's got a thin mattress pad. His legs are shackled to the bottom of the mattress or the concrete slab. His hands are stretched over his head and tied. And Richardson, by the way, he's a small guy. He's less than 5 feet tall. So he said that, by the way, it was winter, and he said the guards opened the window. He was in the very thin paper clothes, and he said he would shiver, and that would make these cuffs cut into his hands and his ankles.
And how long was he four-pointed?
Four-pointed for a day, but in these, and then in restraints for 28 days. At one point, he says that the officials came to him and said, "Look, we'll release you if you take another man that they named as your cellmate." He said, "Well, you know that man has attacked me when we were cellmates at another when we were at another prison." So he was stubborn. Dave Sprout, who's an advocate at something called the Lewisburg Prison Project that helps a lot of these prisoners, said that Sebastian Richardson was the most stubborn man he's ever met.
But he was in prison on drug charges. Why was he in solitary confinement in the first place?
So he had a 35-year sentence for drug trafficking. He was actually prosecuted as one of the higher level members of a gang in Louisiana called the Bottom Boys. And he was sent the SMU, Special Management Unit. You know what this prison is a unit in the federal prison system that's meant for people who are gang members, people who are violent, people who have gotten into a lot of fights before, and people who have gotten into altercations with corrections officers. So Richardson ended up there in 2010 because he assaulted a guard. Now, according to him, he intervened between a fight between a guard and another inmate, but that's how he got sent to Lewisburg.
You've also profiled a man named Royce Brown. Was he in solitary confinement for similar reasons?
So go ahead, Joe.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry, Chris.
Yes. Actually, Royce Brown is not sure quite why he ended up at the SMU. He had several incidents in his time in prison of assaults with other inmates, alleged assaults on officers as well. And he ended up at the SMU, and everyone in this prison is in solitary confinement.
And was he refusing to have a cellmate as well?
At one point, he was. So he showed up there very close to the end of his sentence and said he was worried that if he got celled with someone that he couldn't be compatible with, he'd heard the reputation of Lewisburg. He'd heard about the people there. He'd heard about the officers. This is according to him. And he said that, I'm just worried. I'm so close to getting home, so close to going back to Delaware and my family. I don't want to risk an attack from another inmate that I have to respond to, and I could end up getting a new charge. I could end up having to stay here longer. So he tells us he showed up at the prison and said, "Listen, just put me in a single cell. I don't want any trouble. Let me serve out the rest of my time here." And according to him, officers said, "That's not how things are done here at Lewisburg." And that started a long sort of cycle of him ending up in restraints.
And Joe, you spoke with Royce Brown as part of your investigation for NPR.
We did. We met him. We interviewed him, on the NPR website and the Marshall Project website, we have some of the tape. We actually got video of him being pulled out of a cell and put in restraints.
Do they videotape all of these actions?
Well, they do. When they come in and take someone out by force, they tape these to have a record that they've followed procedures correctly. And we did try to get these tapes when we filed a Freedom of Information Act request, multiple requests. And the prison officials say, "No, we can't give those to you because that would compromise or show how some of our safety procedures." But in Royce Brown's case, his lawyer actually had obtained the tapes in discovery. He was going to be charged with assaulting the corrections officers when he was taken out of his cell. He says, no, look at these tapes. They show that I wasn't the one assaulting anyone. And in fact, indeed, once his lawyer got those tapes, the charges were not filed. I did want to point out, by the way, you mentioned we were talking about the special management unit at Lewisburg. And as Christy said, this is supposed to be a disciplinary place for people who are considered the most violent, most dangerous prisoners. But we found that often many of the people who are there are people actually who don't have a significant history of violence. They're people with significant mental health issues. And sometimes I spoke to one former staffer who said about a third fit that description of people who are supposed to be at Lewisburg who are dangerous. Another third have a significant mental illness. And another third, he said, shouldn't be there. They just got sort of caught in the wrong place, the wrong time. And when in general, when we, Christy and I have done these stories on solitary confinement, there's not a due process if you get charged with something that gets you sent to solitary confinement. You're sent for violating prison rules if there's a safety issue. But it can be any sort of you can end up for assaulting a corrections officer. Sometimes can be threatening them. It can be a verbal assault. So there are a lot of things that can get you put in solitary confinement that we found often seemed like they weren't significant threats to prison safety.
What options do inmates have when they're confronted with a potentially dangerous cellmate?
So what we were told by, you know, the people that we spoke with who had been through Lewisburg, essentially their choices are this. You can, if you see them bringing a new cellmate to your cell, you can say, I can't live with that person. And the consequences for that are end up in shackles for as long as it takes until you essentially give in and say, okay, I'll live with whomever you give me. Maybe at that point, it'll be somebody else who you find slightly more palatable.
Despite the fact that there's a possibility of violence.
Right, because in a lot of cases, it's not necessarily that you know this person is going to assault you. It's that you don't know anything about them at all. You're about to be locked in a tiny cell with no escape with someone that you've been told by the prison is dangerous enough to be in this unit, but you know nothing about them. So that's a risk that all of these men have to take. And if they do take that risk and live in this cell, what many, many, many people told us is that if you say, you realize very quickly that it's going to come to violence, that you're not compatible, those complaints and those fears fall on deaf ears. That the policy at Lewisburg is that unless they actually witness a fight, they won't separate you. So what we were told by many people is that forces them to actually attack their cellmates, as Royce Brown did once, and we have the video footage of it, attack their cellmates purposefully in front of guards so that they see it, take them out, sometimes still put them in those restraints, but then eventually put them into a new cell with a new cellmate.
My guess,
and we should point out, by, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, finish your thought, and then I have to go to a break.
Okay, sorry. We should point out that the prison officials do have a screening process. They do. They say they do try to put people together who are compatible, but often they don't, and we found hundreds of cases every year of violence.
I'm speaking with Joseph Shapiro, an NPR Investigations correspondent, and Christy Thompson, a staff writer for the Marshall Project. Their article, 28 Days in Chains, about the punishments that people at Lewisburg Penitentiary and other prisons have endured was published on October 26th by the Marshall Project. We will continue our conversation after this. And we are back with Christy Thompson, a staff writer for the Marshall Project, and Joseph Shapiro, an NPR Investigations correspondent. We're talking about what they've written in an article called 28 Days in Chains, which appeared in the October 26 issue of the Marshall Project. Well, it was published by the Marshall Project on October 26. Christy, yeah. Let's talk about Lewisburg Federal Penitentiary. And what part of Pennsylvania is it located?
It's in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania, so more rural part of the state.
Is this northeast, southwest? You don't know.
I believe it's western.
Is it similar to most federal prisons?
No. So the Lewisburg Penitentiary is a very specific prison within the federal system. It's essentially the second highest security prison in all of federal prisons. It's called the Special Management Unit. So in 2009, they decided that they were going to send some of their most, as they claimed, most violent, difficult, gang leaders, people who had assaulted a lot of corrections officers, to this unit and put them through a rehabilitation program. And if you fail out of this unit or can't be controlled there, the only last stop is the federal supermax prison in Florence, Colorado.
Well, this report follows a previous investigation about double selling and its dangerous consequences called The Deadly Consequences of Solitary with a Cellmate, which was published in the Marshall Project in March. Now, is it Menard?
Menard.
Menard Correctional Center is in southern Illinois. Are they the only prisons in the country where inmates are forced to share a solitary cell?
No. So that investigation looked at the state prison system in Illinois. But we started looking into this phenomenon more generally. We felt like you always hear about solitary confinement, but actually a huge portion of the people in this state that are locked in their cells for 24 hours a day have another person there. So over 80% of federal prisoners that have that are in some form of restricted housing have a cellmate. And there aren't good numbers about the state system, but over 18 states use this for at least some of the people that are in quote-unquote solitary confinement.
Well, solitary usually means one person, and the cells are usually very small. So, Joseph, why are two people being put into cells that were intended for solitary confinement of one person?
Well, we think it's because prisons are so overcrowded. As I said, when we talked to the Federal Bureau of Prisons, they gave us the justification that it cuts down on suicides. Suicide in solitary confinement is a big problem. But we thought it was an issue of space. Basically, they would just simply add one more bunk to a cell that was set up for one person. And by the way, Leonard, I also want to say that in addition to the print story that ran on both the Marshall Project's website and the NPR website, there are also radio pieces that your listeners might want to hear. So the two radio pieces on Lewisburg ran on All Things Considered on October 26th and October 27th. And in that first one, you can hear Royce Brown. You can hear the sounds of him being dragged from his cell and restrained and his screaming and his complaint. And also the other piece that you mentioned that we did on the first piece on double cell solitary and at Menard, that was March 24th. Also on All Things Considered. And that one, I start by describing the size of a cell at Menard. It's about the size of a king-size bed. So imagine you talk about double-celling two people in a cell the size, the square footage of a king-size bed. You've got two bunks, a sink, and a toilet right there by the bunks. And it's a prescription for violence. That's our argument, that when you put people 23 to 24 hours a day, people who are considered dangerous, that they have to be removed from the general prison population, you put them together in that kind of living condition. I mean, who could any of us live with 23 to 24 hours a day in those kind of conditions? Of course there's violence.
Are there any data on the physical effects of the restraints, any long-term effects, mental or physical?
There hasn't been any research on that fact so far. But in terms of the long-term effects of the restraints, I mean, we met with Royce Brown, who got out of Lewisburg around 2 years ago, and he still has very visible scars around his torso and his wrists. There have been a lot of complaints from men saying that they still have nerve damage in their hands and their feet. And I think you bring up a good point. You know, the mental impact of a trauma like that is definitely something that people talk about as well.
Did you speak with any physicians or nurses who work at the prison?
I spoke with one former, and Joe spoke with another former physician's assistant. So this is an interesting group of people because once the corrections officers put them into restraints, it's their job to check them. And what a lot of the inmates claim is that they check them but never say that anything's wrong. And we've seen in video footage where men will be crying out in pain. The PAs check them and say, you know, circulation's fine, they're fine. But one person told me that, you know, these restraints are meant to be tight, they're meant to be restrictive, and that it's the inmates that cause the injury when they try and move around, is what he told me.
So they should just stay totally immobile? How is that legal?
Well, it is in contradiction.
It sounds medieval.
It does. What he told me is actually in contradiction to what the Bureau of Prisons claims in response to all of these lawsuits. Their argument is that, no, these restraints are used completely legally. I mean, these restraints are meant to be used in prisons for inmates that are completely out of control, that are posing a risk, that are attacking people. It is allowed for the Bureau of Prisons to use them in those circumstances. And they claim in their responses that we apply these restraints in a way that inmates are able to go to the bathroom, able to feed themselves, able to drink water without injuring themselves.
But are they able to eat or sleep in these restraints?
Well, what many, many men told us is that that's not true, that they couldn't take down their pants to use the toilet and ended up soiling themselves, that they couldn't bring a cup to their mouth and ended up being forced to drink out of the toilet, that they struggled to climb onto the bunk beds and so they ended up sleeping on the floor.
Is there a limit as to how much time an inmate can spend in the SMU?
Go ahead,
Jeff. Yes, actually, the Bureau of Prisons just in August changed the rules. They reduced the amount of time that inmates are supposed to be in the special management unit. It's a program that's supposed to sort of, they work with, on workbooks in their cell. They're supposed to sort of go through sort of an attitude adjustment and behavior to deal with anger management and things like that, and then they can go back to a regular prison. But it used to be 24 months, and now it's been cut to a maximum of 12 months. But the thing is that if you, even though it's supposed to be a maximum, there's supposed to be a maximum on it, if you have some violation, if you have some problem, if you get in a fight with somebody or with a corrections officer, you go back and you start all over. There have been people there who've been there for years. There's a large percentage of people who it's very rare, I think, to go through in the minimum amount of time. So there is a limit, but people often end up starting all over. And by the way, when the Bureau of Prisons put these new rules in effect and said the program is not going to be 24 months, it's now maximum of 12 months, that did not apply to the people who were already there. There are about 1,100 prisoners in the special management unit at Lewisburg.
So just to add to that, under the new policies, yeah, they did shorten the program, but they did claim that now someone, if it comes up to 2 years and they still haven't finished the program, that they can't be held there. However, what that means is that many of them might just end up at the federal supermax in Florence, Colorado.
Go ahead.
They also said they would increase the mental health screening of inmates there in these new rules. But by the way, the changes did not address the restraint use.
Now, mental health was a concern when Rikers decided that people under a certain age could not be kept in solitary confinement. But has anybody done studies about what the impact of long-term solitary confinement is on anybody?
There have been many studies about that. There's kind of a trio of psychologists who have done a lot of look at what this kind of long-term isolation, which is, you know, relatively a recent phenomenon, the impact it has. They've even called it SHU syndrome, which is the special housing unit. And one researcher found that after as little as 2 weeks in total isolation, you can start to feel these psychological impacts of things like, you know, withdrawing even more from people, being antisocial. And Joe and I actually did an earlier story about people who came straight from spending months or years in solitary confinement before being released back to their home. And what many of them told us is that they had a hard time going outside. They had a hard time even, you know, reconnecting with their family because you just lose the ability for social interaction.
Are there any programs that, Joe, you mentioned them working on workbooks to help them rehabilitate so that they can function outside of these cells? Are those programs any good?
You know, we didn't assess. We did not assess the program, but the inmates that we spoke to were pretty dismissive of the program at the special management unit at Lewisburg, filling out these workbooks. They say sometimes you let somebody else do it for you, or maybe you do it quickly, and then you get sent back, and you start all over, and you don't do it again. That basically was a kind of warehousing. But I want to point out also, though, that President Obama, in January did announce some new policies that do reduce the use of solitary confinement in federal prisons. And he did, by the way, cite the Kalief Browder case at Rikers Island, although that's a New York City prison, not a federal one. But he and President Obama did an op-ed article in the Washington Post, and he called solitary confinement an affront to our common humanity. And he announced that he was he'd asked the Justice Department to review the use of solitary confinement in federal prisons, and he followed some of their recommendations. So he's banned the use of solitary confinement for juveniles in federal prisons, very small number of people. But and he's also expanded treatment for prisoners with mental illness, and he said that they should spend more time outside of their cells.
But isn't that all directed at privately owned prisons that work within the federal system?
No, that was all federal, for all federal prisons.
Because they have talked about eliminating some of those private prisons, especially the ones that deal with undocumented immigrants.
The ones for the undocumented immigrants, they still use the private prisons. He was referring to the Bureau of Prisons, the prison system, not the ICE detention facilities.
Christy, can you talk about Gerardo Arce Felix, who was killed by his cellmate in 2015?
So Gerardo Arce Felix is someone who kind of encapsulates why the people that end up at Lewisburg are not always, you know, the worst of the worst. He was an older man, 57 years old. He was diagnosed with schizophrenia. He had a lot of mental health issues. And he was serving a relatively short prison sentence for illegally reentering the country after he'd already been deported. And we know through talking to his daughter and his sister and reading the letters that he wrote to them at the time that he was at Lewisburg, that he claimed that he was not getting his medication while he was there.
And why were they denying him his medication? Schizophrenia is something that is treatable through meds.
So we were able to get a copy of his mental health records during his time at Lewisburg. And we have records that show that previously when he'd been in a state facility, he was under, you know, court order to take schizophrenia medication, that the prison there had diagnosed him with this. They found a huge improvement in his behavior when he was on meds. And then we saw the mental health logs from when he was at Lewisburg, and it showed time and time again he would meet with a psychologist and they would say, no mental health issues. Because generally those check-ins are, you know, through a cell
phone. So he was killed by his cellmate?
Yes, and that's a case that's still ongoing.
And we have to leave it there, unfortunately. We hope that some people in Washington have been paying attention to this series. We have links on our show page at wmyc.org/Lopate. And my great thanks to Christy Thompson of the Marshall Project and Joseph Shapiro of NPR for being on our show today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Leonard.